core memory consists of a very large number of tiny little toroids with wires going through them in the X direction and the Y direction, and you magnetize these toroids as a way of storing a bit of information. So are you saying, Paul, that you believe the majority of the memory on board Apollo was that kind of a core memory system? Over you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, they had a million women sewing these things together, if you want to call them sewing them. They're running wires through the washer, little washers. So that was the core memory. And I had it on an index card here, and I just found that it was, the guy's name was Freddie Williams, and his partner was Tom Kilburn. So some people called it the Williams-Kilburn tube back in the 1946, 1947. That's what I'm talking about. It was my earliest form of random access memory for computers. I'm just saying, I could, the power that this thing must have drew must have been enormous to, light off the filaments and everything else. And, 70 different cathode ray tubes, could you imagine? Then I guess they came up with the core memory. The Apollo spacecraft and the, I think the computer in the LEM was transistors, if I'm mistaken. I'd have to look that one up again. The earlier transistors.
Of all the reading you've done on that onboard computer that did their navigating and timing and everything else, do we know the approximate amount of kilobytes of memory capability that was on board? Or another way of looking at it, what do we know about the onboard navigation computer? Was it running at a 1 megacycle clock rate? And did it have 20 kilobytes of data storage? Do we have any numbers like that, Paul? Go ahead. K2LAW.
I know I can find it on the computer. I know I've read it probably a number of times, but it never stuck in my head. I know it wasn't enough to keep all the things that they wanted functioning, pointing of the antenna back to NASA, and pointing of the radar, and calculating the distance between the moon and the LEM. All of it was kind of like overwhelming, but his computer couldn't handle it all. Today, it would have been, a joke, no problem. Back then, it overdid it. They would send out, the message came out as a number, 1202, and then there was no one, 1203. They were alarm messages. It didn't say anything. They didn't have enough memory to even write a word out, on either a printer or even lights. Just a number came up. It's amazing that they put these computers together and they functioned the way they did. Half a dozen different times to put six spacecraft on the surface of the moon, plus all the other ones. I don't know how many bytes they had or memory storage. I know once they shut it off, they would lose the memory because the memory core wouldn't hold onto the RAM.
I used to think that a core memory was a non-volatile memory, that it would hold, when you magnetize those little toroids, those little washers, that they would hold that bit of information when you turn the computer off. I used to think that. Maybe I still do. I believe what happened on Apollo 11 is that when they separated from the command module, and they're in the lunar module, and they're about to go down to the moon, I think they were following their checkoff list, and by mistake, they turned on the ground sensing radar too soon. So the ground sensing radar was operating in the beginning of that lunar landing mission, and that's what overloaded the computer and gave them this 1202.
Simulations. I mean, core memory. I thought they had to keep refreshing it, otherwise they would tend to lose some of the data. You know, one of those deals. But I don't know much about it. I don't remember. Your little calculator on a watch or any dollar calculator from the dollar store have a lot more memory than any of the Apollo missions probably combined.
Whitey White?
Mr. Whitey White, go right ahead.
Well, I've tried looking it up while I waited, and I can't find the reference, but I remember reading that they said a Commodore 64 was slightly more powerful than the computer that was on board the CSM for the Apollo missions.
I guess that doesn't surprise me at all, Hank, that the computers are moving so darn fast in clock rate, RAM, ROM, whole works. Nowadays, with our flash memories, we think nothing of storing on a hard drive. Lots of gigabytes and terabytes. I can remember the so-called hard drive that was being used in the computing system that was in the main simulation room at AIL for the B-1 bomber. And it literally consisted of a great big rack, and inside of this closure had a whole bunch of disks. I'm guessing these disks are either 8 or 16 inches in diameter. And there's probably 10 or 20 of these disks on one spindle. And I don't know the number, but if somebody told me that that had a total memory storage of a megabyte, I would believe it. By modern day standards, we've come a long way. What have you found so far, Hank? Over to you, K2LIW.
Like I said, Dick, I can't find the reference. I was looking for it, but I know I remember reading it. I have a question for Paul, if you don't mind, and one Whitey White.
We've got the time, and you're number one on the runway. Go right ahead, Hank. And by the way, is anybody watching what happened to the awards? You've got it, Hank.
Sorry, I'm not paying attention to the awards. But Paul, my question for you is, and I'm not saying I believe in UFOs that are intelligently controlled within our part of the world or our part of the galaxy, but if you watch NASA stuff, you occasionally see these fast-moving little specks of light that go seemingly impossible trajectories. Do you have any comment on what they might be? Does anybody really know?
Are these pictures that you've seen taken from spacecraft, or, you know, they have anybody talking about them? You know, I've seen a lot of shows where they try to make you believe a lot of things that they do see. You know, they'll show you lights, but they, like one show, they even explained it was a reflection on the glass, you know, of the back part of the spaceship, you know, the almost like a mirror effect. And I've seen that. I think that was just recently. But, you know, I know one thing. They haven't proven that any other is intelligent or another spacecraft. Not one piece of evidence anywhere. Out of all the data, all the blue book stuff that's come out. Hank, what is it that you're trying to describe? Was it a craft? It's just lights, or, you know, something over the Phoenix Mountains or something? Back to you, Hank.
Yeah, let me say a couple words here. On my recordings of Apollo 16, I do remember Mattingly talking about flecks of paint coming off the side of the spacecraft, traveling along with them. So a fleck of paint whistling by the window could give you some peculiar effects. Over to you, Hank.
Well, I certainly believe it could be a fleck of paint, but what I'm referring to in particular is that a lot of times, if you look at the feeds from the ISS, you see white line direction. Also, when you look at some Apollo videos where they show the FM stage of the LE occupant with the CFM, and occasionally they'll show white light across the screen. Could easily be a fleck of paint, but perhaps I just don't really know what they are. The ones in the eye, they're a little hard to perceive just how close they are to any of the spaceships taking one whitey white.
Could be thrusters, you know, firing. Sometimes there's moisture on the outside that freezes up, condenses and freezes. A lot of little things, I'm sure. Take over here. Send light 2H.
Go ahead, Luke.
Just a little bit on core memory, if I can. So each core has a couple of wires through it, so you can select in an XY fashion the particular core that you're interested in. If it's magnetized in one direction, it's a 0. If it's magnetized in the other, it's a 1. When you select the X and the Y, the currents are additive, so you're only affecting that one core, and the other ones don't have enough current to flip them. What you're trying to do is flip it to a 0 state. It may be 0 or 1 at the time, but you're trying to read it, so you flip it to a 0 state. If it was already a 0, not much happens. If it was a 1 and you flipped it, then there's a sensing line that senses the change to an dopant-induced voltage. So it's kind of a destructive read. So that's kind of how that worked in Y2H.
Did they ever set up a system, Lou, where you drive the core towards 0, if it already was 0, you didn't get a flip, you didn't get the signal. If it was a 1, you drove it towards 0, you got a signal. After you read that, you could drive it back to a 1, so that you've read the data, but now you haven't destroyed the data that you just read. I wonder if they've ever set up a system like that, Lou. NY2H, K2RAW.
Exactly. That they would read it. Once they did a read, it was always 0. Now, if it was previously a 1, then they would bring it back to 1. And the way they do that is the direction of current. So you've got two wires, one in the X direction, one in the Y direction. And by manipulating the appropriate directions of current, you can flip it either counterclockwise or clockwise. The magnetic field is tolerated.
So therefore, it's possible to restore the data that you just destroyed in the process of reading it. And if you keep reading and restoring, then your memory keeps all of the data, even though you just read it. And that's what I think can be done. I think you're saying that was a popular mode of operation. Is that true?
No, affirmative. So it was persistent memory. And you're only reading one bit at a time. So if somehow you screwed up, you probably only affect the one bit. But yeah, it was persistent. And apparently it was used up until the 50s. That was the major way they used memory. So, Wikipedia has a good write-up on it, and, but I kind of remembered that's how, right? Then they said later on there's an inhibit line and a sense line, and later on they merged those two lines into one, but basically that's what it is. So you're tickling the particular toroid that you're interested in, and you're watching for a response, and whether you get it or not, you know, if it was initially a 0 or a 1. You know that after you did that exercise, you made it a 0. So if it was a 1 to begin with, you want to flip it back. If it wasn't, there's nothing left to do.
If you lost power, that would be it, right? You would lose your memory, isn't that right?
I don't think so. I think it's a
magnetic spin or turn, if you will, counterclockwise or clockwise, would be persistent. So you wouldn't. No, it was persistent memory. So it didn't need power to keep those states, only to flip them and read them.
They could use it as ROM. Not only that, instead of RAM, they could use it as ROM.
Yeah, exactly, Paul. You got it.
Very good. I'll take over you.
Now, Paul, you know, Lou, you said it was used into the 50s. I think it was used into the 60s. Apollo used that kind of memory. I think that's the majority of their non-volatile memory on board the Apollo spacecraft. Also, I know for a fact that core memory was used on the EA-6B airplane, which was started in the mid-60s and used well into the 70s. In fact, I think some of them, maybe with that core memory, are still flying. So that core memory system, I think, was used well into the 60s, Lou. NY2H, K2RIW.
K2RIW, NY2H. I'm looking here. I quickly saw them mention the 50s, but you're probably right. I mean, okay, here we go.
Oh,
I misread that. You are 100% correct. In fact, the opening of the article says that it was used for 20 years between about 1955 and 1975. There you go. And to this day, you know, sometimes refer to memory as core because of those origins. That NY2H.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, Paul. These computers that we're using for all kinds of memory storage, calculating, and whatever, and now we're starting to combine computers with our radio equipment for software-defined radios, fancy modulation and demodulation techniques. Are these computers going to catch on, or is this this computer and RF interface, is that just a flash in the pan? NY2H, K2RAW?
Well, I'll tell you, it's an interesting question. I don't know if, it appears to me there's a trend here, but that's just a guess.
You think that it might catch on, isn't that just a fad? Well, we might keep this one. I do remember, now, obviously all of that was a pure jest. I do remember when we first started getting things like the, what was the very first now? Tandy computer? No, that was by far downrange. Some of the very early computers where people were saying that eventually I'm going to be using it to control the items in my house. I think we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s. Computers just starting to come along out of the laboratories. There were people then making predictions as to how important they're going to be. And not everyone believed it at the time. I suspect there's rather little doubt now. However, when it comes to artificial intelligence, it's a little bit like nuclear fusion research. When you ask anybody who's working with nuclear fusion, how soon will it be operational? Oh, it's about 20 years away. For the last 50 years, it's always 20 years away. And when it comes to artificial intelligence, I think they kept saying that we'll have artificial intelligence in the next 10 or 20 years. It turns out that what we call intelligence, there's a hell of a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Is that your impression, Lou? NY2H, K2RAW?
One second. Vic, WS2N. If you see a show that comes on recently, it might be shown again on Channel 13, and maybe John saw it. I know he's a big fan of Nova. They had a good show on robots, Rise of the Robots. You got to see this thing. It's incredible. Back you, Dick.
Yeah, I think this is the one where an awful lot of those robots are being taught to walk, and they've got a tether on them, so when they fall over, it doesn't do damage. Is that the show you're talking about, Paul?
That's it. That was great. I'm telling you. You know, you watch what it was like, you know, 20 years ago, and even 40 years ago, and you see what it's like today, and they've really come a long way. But you're right, they're a long way from AI, but still, I mean, they've come a long way with these things.
Hey, Lou, how soon are we going to have artificial intelligence? What's your guess on that one, Lou? And aren't those tiles getting very intelligent? It's a joke.
NY2H. So, Kersey Tone, I think, is back in full swing. Well, maybe not. That was the ID. I believe that the real bang for the buck in the area of neural networks, that is to say, now you have these intelligent programs that kind of can learn, and that's one approach, but neural networks. things like pattern recognition. They already have that, so you can analyze signatures. Let's say you show it enough signatures, and then it learns. The neural network actually learns to discern. So I think that's the key. The machine isn't emulating a particular problem. It's emulating the nature of the construct of our neurological system. And I think that's where you're going to get a lot of bang for the buck.
You know about the so-called Turing test for whether or not you've got artificial intelligence. Do you see some number of years in the future in which a machine will pass the Turing test, and that's where you start talking to a machine that's on the other side of the wall, and after you've asked it a whole lot of questions and you got a whole lot of answers, you can't tell the difference as to whether or not that's a man or a machine, then AI to some degree has arrived. But the neural networks trying to emulate a human brain, that's a pretty tall order. I think you've got either 10 to the 11 or 10 to the 12 neurons, a 3.5-pound human brain, and each one of those neurons have got a large number of interconnects with other neurons. So that wiring diagram, that three-dimensional wiring diagram, is extremely elaborate. And I'm having trouble believing that that we're even though we can put a billion transistors on a transistor on a chip, that doesn't mean we can emulate easily that three-dimensional structure. Over to you, Paul. K2RAW.
I think you mean Lou. He's better with computers than me.
Yeah, I should have said Lou. Over to you, Lou.
NY2H. Well, as far as the Turing test, you can see the trajectory. Now you have things like Siri on the telephone. Excuse me. Hold on a second. All right, I had to clear my throat. I'm not suggesting we're anywhere near, the Turing threshold with Siri, but we're on the way with apps like that. And I think we'll get there. As far as the complexity of the human mind, yeah, you're right. I mean, but again, Moore's Law and, networked systems. I think you can put enough capacity together at some point. And again, we're not teaching this thing, this artificial or neural network anything directly. It's learning. It's modifying those connections. You don't have to map those. All you have to do is provide the substrate, and it equalizes to a state. And provide it with enough, just like a baby, and you provide it with enough information. Now, you might need some inherent initial conditions, like group one, I guess, with certain faculties, and then others are grown over that. So I think it's possible. I would say it's a possible, attempt, and whether we get there fully, we probably won't see it, but at some point, I don't see why not. If our existence continues, given enough time, but we may see some amazing things, too, towards those directions. But I'm kind of a believer in that. And Bill Gates and a couple of people are warning, be careful with this stuff, because it is powerful.
In the case of a human mind that learns a particular piece of information, I think what you're doing is establishing certain neural paths between neurons. I'm not quite sure what goes on there, but by some means you make a quasi-permanent connection between these dendrites, or whatever they're called. In the case of a computer emulating a human mind, a neural network, where it wants to learn something, yeah, you could do a kind of learning by way of burning certain interconnects. I'm having trouble believing that's the way it's done. How does the neural network, artificial machine, establish certain interconnects in the process of learning information? Over to you, Lou, K2RAW.
K2RAW, NY2H. There are constructs. Now, again, I have a very slow computer here, but I'm just clicking it to cheat a little bit. But, for example, there are a number of layers, and there are feedback paths, and they're emulating, you're right, the dendrites. The dendrites are all the many feeds that go out, and then the come in, actually, those are sensors, sensing other neurons, and then the axon is the output of the neuron. So that particular neuron becomes programmed in a sense where, let's say it has 20 dendrites coming into it. It'll say, pay particular attention to 3, 5, and 7, flip anything that comes in on dendrite 8. So it almost becomes like a digital logic circuit. And, you know, if you reach this threshold, and I don't think it's totally digital, there might be some analog, there might be thresholds involved, then send a signal down the axon, or send the pulse, or send the pulse followed by an inversion, whatever. But there's an enormous amount written up on some of the mathematical techniques they use, the weighting, the layers, feedback, and there's the stuff working now. As I said, pattern recognition is a big field where they're using this. So you could see snippets of code, you could see the underlying constructs that they use. There's really a lot there. I don't know that much, but I know it's out there, and something that you can check out in Y2H.
Lou, do you have any idea who is funding this research right now? Who's funding it, and what's their motivation?
Well, firstly, I think a lot of it was in the just mathematical research. Whether it be pure, you know, research, and then now it's being applied. I think you have people interested enough for discovery here and for experimentation. I don't know what the government is doing. I don't know what industry might be doing, but you know, I can do further research for you and give you some ideas. Maybe I could find a current representative, state-of-the-art tome out there. But I do know that you know, that they've been successful in particularly pattern recognition. So I don't know if this big data move now is going to use some of it also to discern. You know, you have a lot of data, but the key is to go in there and analyze it. So. I think artificial intelligence will exceed human intelligence. There you go. Putting it out there.
That's probably a safe prediction. However, is it going to exceed human intelligence in 10 years, a century, a millennium? What's your guess as to how long it might take, Lou?
Now, again, I'm not really in a position to say, but just gut feel, it should be a while. I'm just buzzing through something here. So here's several strategies for learning. One's called supervised learning. Essentially a strategy that involves a teacher that is smarter than the network itself. For example, let's take the facial recognition example. You show the computer a bunch of faces. The teacher knows the names already associated with each face. The network makes guesses. So when it has a correct guess, that will strengthen certain connections in the neural network. So there's a series of tests. Then you go on and you, once it learns, then it knows. Hold on one second, let me drop. Then they talk about unsupervised learning. It's required when there isn't an example data set that exists. It says imagine searching for a hidden pattern in a data set. An application of this is clustering, dividing a set of examples into groups according to some unknown pattern. I don't really give you any examples there. And then is reinforcement learning. So, I mean, to the uninitiated, you'd be amazed that, oh, here's something, pattern recognition, time series prediction, signal processing, control, soft sensors. For example, a thermometer can tell you the temperature of the air, but what if you also knew the humidity, barometric pressure, dew point, air quality, air density, etc.? Neural networks can be employed. deployed to process the input data from many individual sensors and evaluate them as a whole. So maybe you have weather prediction. And you see they have weather models now. I don't know necessarily that the neural networks. It just might be expert systems. But I think it's a continuum. We'll get more and more advanced as time goes on. You know, when it exceeds human, I have no idea. Probably way out there in time.
Here's another crazy question, Lou. The neural networks that are being used to emulate a human brain and or a human brain, is either of those analog, digital, or is it some kind of combination of analog and digital? And by the way, the word digital doesn't necessarily mean binary. It can be trinary. But are either of those memories digital, analog, or some kind of a combination? What's your guess on that one, Lou? K2RFW?
All right, I missed the first. You said something, and then you said the human brain.
Either the neural networks that are trying to emulate the human brain or the human brain, are either of those or both of them digital, analog, or some kind of a weird combination of digital plus analog? What's your guess? Over to you, Lou, K2RIW.
Yeah, my guess is some kind of combination. I think there are threshold levels. You know, the human brain, you know, I don't know. I mean, you have the synapse, and then you jump across the synapse, right? So it's electrochemical, really, right? How does that express itself? I think the idea of having multiple inputs and one output and then being able to have internal logic to do things, make your calculation based on the states of those inputs, allows, you know, in some respect, given enough resolution, digital becomes analog. So, I think it's a difference without a distinction.
Question for Lou. You got it, John.
Lou, are they working, or have you heard them working, because I believe I did, on organic gates and systems like that, because they believe that if they can get that working, it will make its own connections as required. Have you followed any of that study?
I have not followed it, but it makes perfect sense. And I think that's right. You know, I mean, they're kind of doing what evolution did, except now we have a thumb on the scale. We can push it in the direction that we want. I just find it very fascinating, and I kind of feel a little bit awkward now for my lack of knowledge, but I'm just trying to paint a little picture of my perception of what's going on now and what the possibilities are. But again, you know, the internet is your friend, and there's probably more material. You could dig deeply into this stuff and have enough material. And it's real. This is not hypothetical. I mean, you know, a lot of math, a lot of examples. So I would encourage anyone who is interested to do a little of that.
Very good. Interesting stuff. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to throw out a question to the group. I should know and I don't know. There are all kinds of light-emitting diodes, different colors, different efficiencies, different raw materials. But a whole section of light-emitting diodes are called OLEDs. I think it stands for organic LED. What makes them call a particular light-emitting diode organic? Is it made out of living materials? Somehow I doubt it, but what is an OLED, if any of you guys know? K2RIW?
You know, this is one of these fields where I looked that up once, so I'm looking it up again because I forgot. An organic light-emitting diode is a light-emitting diode in which the emissive electroluminescent layer is a film of organic compound that emits lights in response to an electric current.
Eric knows about them.
Yeah, Eric may not be with us right now. So, it contains organic material. You can make a weird... I mean, are the little bacteria in there, is it actually alive? And At one time, I knew the definition of organic versus inorganic. I think organic means at least it had the capability to be part of a living organism at one time. Is that one of the definitions of an organic substance, Lou?
Might it be reproducible?
Well, I think it basically it would be a hydrocarbon. So you have organic chemistry, right? The whole field of study, and that's based on the carbon atom. And the carbon atom can connect and house so many different structural configurations of molecules that, you know, that you build upon that and get your amino acids, enzymes, proteins, and all that good stuff. So I imagine it's just the chemistry. I don't think it reproduces itself. Although I suppose you could develop organic material that would reveal that. I don't see what the advantage would be in an LED doing that. But yeah, I think it's basically that it's based on organic chemistry principles and carbon, you know, carbon.
WS to N.
Go ahead, Paul.
I know, OLEDs, that's what the new TV sets are going to be like. And the quality is supposed to be really, really superb. But how they work, I don't know. I just want to know if you've come across the COB, C-O-B, LED lights. You know, I got a flashlight, a little flashlight. You cannot believe how bright this thing is. You can't look at it. It's so bright. I don't know if you came across this thing. That, you know, with a couple of little pen light batteries, and no idea how bright this thing is. It looks like a white tape when you look at it, or maybe like a warm yellowish beige type of tape. That's COB LEDs.
I'm not sure. I do own a LED flashlight. One of them has got a whole bunch of individual LEDs. But I own one flashlight, which has got a single parabolic reflector, one tiny little bulb right at the focal point. This thing runs on three, AAA batteries, and extremely bright, like you said. It goes for a large number of hours on those batteries, and very, very bright, and one and only one bulb. And the light coming out of there is very, very white, slightly bluish. I bought that flashlight about 6 months ago. Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Now, this looks like a tape, like adhesive tape, but like a yellowish look. COB stands for chip on board. I think that's what it is. COB. Can't believe how bright this is. It's, I don't know what else they use it for, but I was shocked. I could imagine them using it in spotlights or something, but it's, you know, it's a flashlight, and it still makes a dark day, I'll tell you. It's incredible. Great for leaving in a car, that type of thing. I think I got it over in Ace. My wife picked it up in hardware, you know, for under $10.
You're going to have to give me some words on this one, Paul. You said it's a tape. My next question is, all right, a strip of tape, how wide, how long? Does it have a bunch of bright dots on the tape where the light-emitting diodes are located? Or is it the whole darn tape that's lighting up? And if it's a whole long strip of light, how do you pack that into a flashlight? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, you know, if you took a regular flashlight, just took a long piece of tape, maybe 2.5 inches long, 3/8 of an inch wide, put it on the, you know, put it in there, and that's your light. It's a rectangular flashlight, really. Apparently, you don't see individual bulbs. It looks like you're looking at a piece of tape. The whole freaking thing lights up. Gotta Google this thing. COB. There's a chip on board LED.
Okay, you described the piece of tape as 3/8 of an inch wide, 2.5 inches long, and they put the whole tape in there. Okay. Is that piece of tape sitting in front of a parabolic reflector in front of the flashlight? Or is it stacked down the hollow tube of the flashlight? How does that light get out of there? Is that light focused in any way? So go to the next step of describing. The tape is in the flashlight, but how is it in the flashlight? Is it just floating in the empty space right in front of the batteries? Over to you, Paul, K2LAW.
No, it's just flat, almost like somebody taped it down. You know, I'm not even sure how the substrate is arranged, but that's what it looks like. There's no parabolic reflectors or anything. It's just a piece of glass over it. You can see yellowish-looking flat thing behind it, and that's what lights up. And that's it. I'll have to read more about it. I thought you were going to say you've heard of it, but apparently not. Carb tape, not carb tape, carb LEDs.
Is that piece of tape that's 2.5 inches long, is it put inside the flashlight parallel to the major axis of the flashlight? And is it somehow being suspended in the geometric center of the flashlight? How does the tape go into that flashlight, Paul? Go ahead.
It's just a handle that you hold on to. That's where your batteries are, and then at the top of that handle, a big fat long pen, and the top part of the pen, they have this that's inside this glass. You know, you can't touch it. You can't touch the tape. It's closed. But I'll have to look at it again. Nobody's seen it before, huh? Okay. It looks like it's probably manufactured in rolls or something. Let's rip it off and attach it to the tape, to the flashlight. That's what I imagine, but I don't know. I'll have to look further into it.
To APG. Yeah, my first question, Dave, is does the light come out broadside to the piece of tape? Is the whole side of the flashlight glass and it radiates in all directions? Or is the light coming out of the thing focused in some way? Over to you, Dave.
Yeah, I just punched it up. I've seen a couple of them at the flea markets. It's very nice, very bright. The illuminator, the LED illuminator, it looks like a flat panel. What Paul is describing is a tape. In other words, it's a rectangular shape, and it illuminates in one direction, kind of like a panel antenna.
Comment, Dick?
Go right ahead, Hank.
Nope, it was Mike.
You got it, Mike.
Yeah, Dick, this is K1MJM. I have some Cobb LEDs. If you light them up with just a little tiny bit of juice, just enough to turn them on, you'll see it's an array of LEDs that are facing all in the same direction. It looks like a piece of, mine looks like yellow tape, actually, but it's actually about a half inch square, maybe a little bit less than a half inch square, and it has 16 LEDs. If you just put a little bit of electricity to it, just enough to light it up. That's all. K1MJM, back over to you.
And is all of that mounted behind a piece of glass at the front end of the flashlight? And is it radiating broadside like a focal plane array? Go ahead.
Roger that. Yes, it's radiating like a focal plane array, and there's a piece of, looks like frosted glass or plastic in front of it. Yes.
NY2H.
And Lou, is the light coming out of there focused in any way, or is this sort of a floodlight? You got it, Lou.
Okay, it sounds to me it's just based on the OLED organic technology, because I'm reading about that here, and rather than a bulb, OLED uses a series of thin light-emitting films, and they have a substrate. It's very flexible, so they can make all sorts of like things like watches that'll go right around your whole wrist, whatever. It's very thin. An OLED panel is typically composed of four primary layers: the substrate, which acts as the structural framework; the anode, which draws electrons; the cathode, which provides electrons; and the organic layer in between. That organic layer is further divided into a conducting layer, which provides the electron holes that the electrons flowing through the layer can snap into, shedding energy in the process, and the emissive layer, where the light is actually produced. And then if you want color, they actually just put in tinted plastic layers into the substrate. But apparently they can even put these things on top of one another. It says rather than an array of individual LED bulbs, OLED uses a series of thin light emitting films. This allows the OLED array to produce brighter light while using less energy than existing LCD and LED technologies.
Great stuff. We're about to be cut off. That was TechNet number 1591, Space Report number 190. Be kind to each other. Pass it over to John and then Paul in that order. KC2WGB. Tie some ribbons on it, John. And by the way, what kind of response did we have on Echo Link? Were there a couple of sign-ins tonight? You got it. That weren't watching the Academy Awards? You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Yeah, we had 8 or 9 that were drifting in, but good attendance. But not everybody watches that nonsense, at least. And good stuff, Lou. And thanks for cleaning up the chat room. So I'll say good night and thank everybody for joining us. Thank you for the questions. Always appreciate it. And send some more. We'll try to answer them. KC2WGB. Back to you, Dick. And everybody have a good time.
I don't normally care about the Oscars that much, but maybe I hope Martian won. That should have won something. I'll give that one the award. We'll see how that did. Dick, over to you, 73 guys.
Very fine, Paul. I liked Martian. However, when you look at that suit he was wearing, in reality, you put 15 pounds per square inch of pressure inside of a suit. That suit is going to look inflated. His suit didn't look inflated. Those are minor details. And nowhere in the movie did they show you anything about how he handled waste product removal. Did you notice that, Paul? How did he remove waste products? Over to you, Paul, KGRIW.
Yeah, I guess that's why they call it a movie and not a documentary. Documentary would have told you that. And they do have some kind of form-fitting suits that they're working on for people that are going to be walking around on Mars. There's a whole thing involved with that. NASA's working on that. So they said his suit would kind of like be the way it is. We'll see. Got to wait about, I don't know, probably 20 years at least. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there's a female astronaut who's been working on a form-fitting suit. And you've got a huge conflict of interest of holding back all of that air pressure and yet still maintaining flexibility. Very difficult requirement. Bye-bye, you all. We'll settle some of these issues next week. KGRIW clear but listening.
Quick antenna question, Dick. APG.
We might get cut off, but give it a go, Dave.
Yeah, on the Long Island Expressway, headed towards Queens, there appears to be a panel type, a small rectangular panel antenna that's mounted on a pole that comes out over the right lane of the expressway. I've only seen one of them, and I was curious if anybody knows what that is. It appears to be some sort of antenna. It's relatively small.
You sure it's not a photovoltaic array, Dave?
Yeah, positive. It's the only one like it. There are street lights on the side of the road. This is not a street light. It comes out over the road, over the right-hand lane, so it looks like it'll pick up not only the right-hand lane, but maybe the middle and the left lane as well. It's a relatively small antenna. By that I mean maybe it's rectangular in size, and maybe it's about a square foot, something like that. It's pretty small.
Is it a weigh station?
It's just over the road.
Roughly where is it? What exit number or what town?
As you go westbound, it's after the Cross Island, and I think it's before the Clearview. Next time I pass it, I'll have to get a better location on it. But I've only seen the one. It's all by itself, and it looks like some sort of antenna, like they're, the cars obviously go by it. It's sensing something. I think it's for truck sticks.
What do you think it's sensing?
The trucks use it for the weigh stations when they weigh in at once. It's like an easy pass for trucks.
That makes some sense. I know of some of the fixed RFID antennas are roughly a 1 foot square flat panel that usually is about inch and a half, 2 inches thick.
So what is it sensing? The trucks have something on the trucks that it's picking up?
Is that your guess, Hank, that it's a tag, the RFID tag on the truck?
It was Mike again. Sorry, Dick.
Mike, your voice sounds a little bit like Hank, so I'm going to get confused from time to time. So your guess is it's a RFID tag on the truck, Mike?
Roger that, Dick. When they weigh in at one-way station within a certain distance or a certain amount of time, they don't have to stop at the next one, and that's an RFID tag that tells the people at the way station that that truck is either okay or not okay to bypass the way station.
But the next question is that there's really no way stations on the expressway in the city.
Could be radiation detectors.
20 minutes up to a certain exit, they do that by RFID on the Easy Pass.
W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System. thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
W4NYF.